CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 166, with Dr. Tim Steineman, advocating for resident surgical teaching and also advocating for patients.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest. I was scrolling Instagram, like many of us always do, and I said, wow, this one ophthalmologist has so much great teaching material, like all the time. I'm learning from this. And I said, I got to invite him to the podcast. And that is Dr. Tim Steineman. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Uday, and delighted to be here. And by the way, congratulations on your 3,000th CataractCoach.com. I can't tell you how we appreciate those tutorials, because it's something that is definitely near and dear to my heart. And being with the residents in the OR 2 days a week, we invoke your teaching knowledge weekly.
I'm honored. I mean, obviously, we all learn together. Now, tell us about your background. And you work with residents, you have a private practice. How does this all work out?
I'm appointed at MetroHealth, and I've done a variety of things in Cleveland for the last 27 years, including private office part-time. But I devote 100% of my time at MetroHealth. MetroHealth is a community hospital, and it is also one of the prime teaching facilities for Case Western Reserve University. Now, having said that, I'm appointed at Case academically, but I don't work at University Hospital, which is the other primary hospital affiliate. But there was a time years ago when we proctored both the UH and the Cleveland Clinic residents. And probably 15 years ago, UH was establishing an increased presence at the VA hospital. So now, for the last 15 years, it's strictly Cole Eye Institute Cleveland Clinic Foundation residents. And so we basically have their residents spending about half of their residency time with us. And I'm proud to say the senior residents spend a very large part of their time with me personally in the operating room. Metro being a community hospital, it's an exciting place to be still, even as a teacher, because we see everything. Mm-hmm. And we are, until recently, the only level one trauma hospital in Cleveland. So we see horrendous stuff. And it's a great place to learn. I'm a firm believer, and you'll find out I'm passionate about experiential learning, which is why CataractCoach.com absolutely appeals to me and appeals to the residents, because we can always take some very, very good teaching nuggets from the 10 minutes or so that you devote to it. And you can basically do it on the run. You can do it between patients practically, and we love it. And when you can see it, you'll remember it. And this is the thing that I want to try to kind of get on to your reader or to your viewers, is that, gosh, I mean, you can see my gray hair. I've been doing this a long time. I finished my residency in 1989. So that means, proudly, I will tell you this, I am the last generation of non-FACO trained residents. I had to pick this up, and I had to teach myself FACO, and I did. And I'm a firm believer that you can do lots of stuff. You have to if you want to stay current.
Right,
and
right.
I think you talked about this in one of your previous many podcasts. But I think you were talking to Steve Safran about this. But it's so important. The hardest part is not learning it. The hardest part is staying current. And that's part of my modus operandi working with the residents. I learn as much from them as I try to continue to give back to them. So Metro, like I say, is a great place to do it. We are basically level one trauma. We have a huge population of people that don't go to doctors very often. We see tons of traumatic, complicated cataracts. Cataract worldwide is still obviously the number one cause of blindness and disability worldwide, but you're not supposed to go blind in the United States. Well, all I would say is, come to Metro. I'll show you lots of people that go blind from cataracts. We see them on a weekly basis, and it's great for the residents, and I'm happy to help them as they, you know, kind of approach some of these daunting cases, made less daunting because of the video nuggets that you share every week.
Right. I think those types of facilities are fantastic for not only helping patients who desperately need it, but teaching in the residence where you're learning on some of the toughest cases. So I did something very similar. In the past, I used to be a professor for UCLA, where I taught exclusively at a big county hospital. So I actually didn't go to the private, you know, UCLA Center in Westwood. I was the county hospital. And same thing, white cataracts, breast cataracts, every single week. Trauma, ruptured globes, every week.
Absolutely. And so I couldn't agree with you more. I tell the residents, if you can do these, you can work anywhere, basically anywhere in the world, because we do see our share of manual small incision cataracts too. It's not common, not as common as they used to be, but we occasionally see Coca-Cola cataracts, you know.
Well, as you see on Cataract Coach, I still put videos every so often for M6. I think it's such a fantastic procedure. In my Beverly Hills private clinic, I still do M6 at least once every month, once every other month.
Wow.
Because their patient referred to me really brunescent rocks of a cataract, zonulopathy, and then you look at the endothelial cell count of the corneas, you know, 1,000. You're like, you know, I'm not going to fake all this for 30 minutes. You're just going to get it right out of your eye.
Well, you know, I've had a similar type of patient where I got through the phaco. I was personally doing it, brown cataract. I did the first eye phaco, came back a couple of weeks later and did the other eye manual. And then I asked him, I said, which one did you like better? He goes, the manual one, because there wasn't as much corneal edema.
Right. You know, in fact, there's a famous study that was published with David Chang doing phaco with identical type of cataracts compared to Ruit, who's like the world's, you know, most famous probably M6 surgeon, and the results were better with the M6.
Right, right. So I tell the residents, don't be afraid of manual. If you can do these, you can literally, I said, you want to be busy right away. Tell people wherever you end up, tell them that you like to do anything and you'll be busy right away. Because I'm sure in the private world, no matter where you are, a lot of these people get passed over. People just don't want to do tough cases.
Yeah, I can understand. You know what? I can understand why too. So I think it's a great, you have a fantastic learning facility there. I think the seeing that breadth of kind of trauma, ruptured globes, but even on the other side, really brunescent cataracts, zonulopathy, and kind of everything in between, you're probably seeing patients with multiple things at once, right?
Exactly. We see people, I mean, everybody that walks in the door is a vasculopath. So we work closely with our retina service, who also comes from the Coli Institute Cleveland Clinic Foundation. And, you know, I can't say enough about Coli Institute, now led by Sunil Srivastava. And I worked with Sunil side by side at Metro for, God, close to 15 years. And so we've developed a very strong relationship with the retina service. And that's the other thing. We have such great retina support that, again, me personally, I'm not afraid to, we tackle anybody that comes our way. And no, I don't look forward to complications. And I tell the residents, I don't wish anything bad on you, but you'll learn a heck of a lot more from these tough cases than you will from doing yet another, you know, 20-50 cataract, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's really nice to have the ability to have a complication with your attending, with your professor sitting next to you. Because I tell residents, I just tell them, when you graduate, a couple years from now, you look in the operating room, you have a complication, and you look to your left, and you look to your right, and it's only you sitting there. There's no one to help.
That's exactly right. And it's got to be a better feeling. And that kind of leads into my other passion that I'm very passionate about teaching cataract surgery and working. We've got great residents, and they're way more poised than I ever was as a resident. But at the same time, I will say this, that we see all comers, and it's a joy to work with them. I'm glad to be part of this whole process. And you're right, it's a lot easier to approach it with somebody sitting by your side. And I will tell you, again, see my gray hair, I'm a product of old school. And you know what? For the most part, I feel like this about old school. I really, truly, a lot of it was time. I mean, even learning cataract surgery, I did a lot of it on my own. Or you learn from your senior residents, you're scrubbing with seniors. And don't get me wrong, you can do it, and trial and error does work. I don't recommend it.
Right.
And obviously for Medicare and billing status, you can't do that anymore. You've got to be there, but I want to be there. And I think the residents appreciate having me there. Gosh, I'm very honored to say that I have won the Teacher of the Year award at the Cleveland Clinic about half a dozen times. And so pretty pretty that's honored awesome. To work with these guys.
Yeah, that's how you and I come from the same cloth. I'm the same way. Here, behind me there, I have the golden apples.
Cool.
Joel Stein from UCLA. So, no, it's an amazing opportunity really to work with them. Now, you have how many residents work with you at any given time?
At any given time, we have half of the resident complement. So we have they have a total of they just switched to a five-year program. The internship is incorporated into, and so instead of an internship plus three, you've got an internship plus three and with five per, so that would be 20 residents. Gotcha. So at any given time, we have about half of them with us, and the other half are rotating over at Cole Eye Institute.
Now, one of the challenges I always had was, there's a little bit of variability, obviously, in everyone's ability, but how do you get all your senior residents to be more efficient? Because I'm sure one of the things you're straddled with, like me, you're stuck with limited OR time, and you want to get the most throughput possible, because I'm sure you have wait lists for every kind of surgery. So would you work with the residents to, like, let's increase the number of cases we can book in this 8-hour block?
We do well with that. First of all, I'm very lucky to have, I have two full operating room days a week. So I see patients on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and we have full Tuesday, full Thursday with the residents. And really and truly, anything is fair game. I, particularly after the first few weeks in the summertime, they're doing everything.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not working with somebody that's doing their first cataract. So sure. They've done quite a bit already by the time they've come to me. I bet you they've done, I'm guessing, 30 or 40 cases by the time they're a senior, maybe even more, 50 cases. And again, it's a credit to this incremental autonomy that they have at Cole. Cole has an excellent wet lab and an excellent simulation lab. Mm-hmm. And all the first years and all the second years have a weekly tutorial. And this is actually, I'm pretty excited to share this with you. This was just published in the Journal of Academic Ophthalmology. Now, kind of a dry topic, but you'll understand the title is Impact of a Formal Pre-Surgical Curriculum on Resident Cataract Outcomes. And this was authored by one of our former residents, Shirley Wu, W-U. Shirley finished last spring, and she's now the cornea and refractive fellow over at Cole Eye Institute. So I'm still in contact with Shirley. I'm a co-author on this paper. She did a bang-up job looking at pre-wet lab and tutorial and post-wet lab. Bottom line is, they looked at hundreds of cases. We're talking before the wet lab and the tutorials. And as I said, the first and second years, this is not an optional sort of thing. They don't just kind of drop by there if they feel like it. It's required. Their schedule is cleared every Wednesday morning. So starting in the summer, right when they begin, every single Wednesday morning, 8 to 12, they've got basically closely proctored wet lab and IC simulation lab. So these guys get really comfortable using a microscope, using their hands, using instruments, using pig eyes, and they have people like Jack Shaw, who is also submitted, he's a huge cataract surgeon at Cole Eye Institute. Jack is a former resident. Jack changed his interest from retina to cataract because he did a rotation with me, I'm proud to say. But Jack works closely with him. And I got to say, the results show, because I'll read you the results of this study. They looked at the pre and post, and the post and pre-wet labs showed, they were compared, the residents post had shorter operative time, significantly lower rates of posterior capsular rupture, significantly lower rates of anterior capsular tearouts, and people that completed the wet lab compared to no completion had significantly increased best corrected vision, and they were more efficient. They finished the cases more quickly. So by the time they get to me, these guys are
pretty damn good.
They're comfortable.
Yeah.
They're comfortable. And I let them go. And I'm there right there with them. But I got to tell you, they're way more poised than I ever was. I mean, for me, it was like 1 year, you know, for the first year, you're dripping BSS on the cornea. And then suddenly one day somebody says, sit down. And I had no training. Or, right. You know, you try to learn it from a book, you know, Norm Jaffe, you know, the art of cataract surgery, now updated by his son, Glenn Jaffe. But I will, again, I'll keep coming back to it. I'm a visual learner. I think we're all, to some extent, visual learners. I'm an experiential learner. So it was always hard for me to read from a book and then have it translate, particularly in front of, you know, an attending sitting there breathing down your neck, wanting to be done with an extra cap in 20 minutes. It's not going to happen.
You know? Right. No, I totally agree with you. That's the new generation actually is very impressive. I think they can learn in 1 year what took us 10 years.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. And on one of your previous podcasts, what you said was, or your guest said, it's harder to be a resident now. Yes and no. There's more to learn. Obviously, way more is expected of them, both from attendings, but also from patients. I mean, right. The patient's expectations, you've seen this before. The patient is sitting there, you know, ready to be rolled out of the room. They're sitting up and they're going like this. Well, there's a little bit blur in my eye. Well, yeah, you just had that instrument in about 5 minutes ago. It's ridiculous. So, yeah. I mean, the technology is awesome, but I will say that the patient expectations are sky high too, even at a community teaching hospital.
No, that is for sure. So I think, yeah, I'm actually very, very proud of the new generation. They're doing a fantastic job and, yeah, keeping up with learning so many things. And I agree with you, the surgical simulators are fantastic. There's the IC one, which we also used previously at UCLA, but even now I don't know if you've seen the new one from helpmesee.org. These are unbelievable. At the coming ASRS or CAD meeting, you should go test drive it. They're amazing. Yeah. They're really quite good.
To me, it's a joy to work with these guys because they're not futzing with the microscope. They are not futzing with their hands. They're not wasting time. They're not rushing. And I say the last thing in the world I want you to do is rush. Just be efficient. And they're very efficient. They're very poised. And again, it's a credit to all of this training that they get early on as residents. And likewise, I would say in some respects, it's easier to learn this stuff now because there's so many great resources, cataractcoach.com, but also, I mean, I'm going to read it off here. I mean, the granddaddy of them all, one of my favorites, even going back to residency, was Bob Osher, the Video Journal of Ophthalmology.
Godfather, the best.
Yes. And so, I mean, you've got him, you've got David Chang. My favorite at the Academy every year is, you know, Spotlight on Cataract Surgery, the Monday Spotlight. That course, I mean, honestly, I've never been disappointed by learning stuff. And the other thing that I love, I feel like years ago, people didn't let their hair down so much. These days, I like to see all the dirty stuff, and they're not afraid to show it. They'll show. They'll say, "What would you do next?" And they freeze it, and then you vote. I mean, I love it. I mean, I love seeing the complications or the near complications. I mean, you've got other stuff. You've got you have featured Steve Safran. I'm trying to think here who else. Brandon Ayers from Wills Eye Hospital. Obviously, Ike Ahmed. Trying to think here. Who else?
I've actually not had Ike on the podcast. I've asked him no less than 10 times. Wow. And I don't know the reason why, but he doesn't want to be on the podcast.
Wow. There's a new guy that I see him a lot on Instagram. His name is Rami Shasha. He's quite good. So there's a lot of really good content out there. And as I said, it's very approachable. And more important, it's free.
Yeah, that's part. Well, you know what else it's done? It's kind of really democratized worldwide surgical education. Because in the past, well, if you trained in this great program, you'd have learned so much. But if you trained in, say, some other program or some other country even, you may not have had access to that kind of teaching. But now, thanks to your phone, everyone's got everything. There's no secrets anymore.
You know, it's absolutely fabulous. And as I said, it's in many ways harder to be a resident, but in some ways, as I said, because I believe so strong in the whole concept of experiential learning and visual learning, I think that's the key. It was hard to learn a lot of this stuff to teach yourself from a book and have it translate into the operating room, or even remembering it. I'm going to post all these weird pictures that you've seen on Instagram. I'm going to post them a gazillion times. I've seen, and in fact, we're just getting ready to publish this, but I saw my first case. I'm cornea trained. and I've been doing this 35 years, and I don't do exclusively cornea. I do mostly adult general ophthalmology, but I've seen lots of cornea disasters. But I saw my first case 2 years ago by diagnosis of exclusion, Morin's ulcer. I never saw one. Yeah. And we saw this guy. He presented through the emergency room at MetroHealth. He was going blind in both eyes. We saved his eyes. We saved tectonically both eyes. He would have perforated. And we saved the vision. In both eyes, he developed cataracts. One eye, because the cornea was not as badly affected, we ended up doing phaco. He ended up 20/20 in one eye, but because he's got a dense scar and neovascularity of his cornea, he still hand motions. But if those vessels regress, I'll do a PK on him.
Wow. Such interesting wild cases. I'll tell you my craziest one I ever saw at County Hospital. Patient with bilateral sterile corneal ulcers.
Yeah.
Bilateral. And then we finally got to the truth. The truth was there were anesthetic induced from smoking crack cocaine.
Oh, I've seen that lots of times. It's a bitch to get those things to heal. And you culture and reculture. And, you know, I mean, we're the same situation at Metro. We see anyone. So smoking crack cocaine or people who steal anesthetic bottles from the clinic or the emergency room. I saw my first case of people that are smoking meth. So meth can do it. I saw a case of somebody that was smoking fentanyl that had, again, a sterile ulcer.
Wow. In my case, we had the our solution was they had to wear goggles while they were smoking the crack. They wouldn't stop. No. At least wear these goggles.
And, you know, you're absolutely right. They're not going to stop. And we try to get them stabilized because I know once we say goodbye, they're not coming back.
Right.
So I'll try to put a conjunctival flap over it, or if they're perforating or near perforating, I will do a graft, and then I'll put a flap over the graft if they have one good eye.
Wow, wild, wild, wild stuff. I mean, now tell me about your Instagram. You were mentioning it briefly. I love yours because you have such great teaching points, and you bring it. It's not just surgical. You bring up great, unusual cases that probably I should have studied for the boards 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, again, a lot of this stuff you see once in a blue moon. Right. And for instance, last week, I think it was last weekend was the OCAP. So I was really on a spree of posting the weirdest stuff that I could find. And I've seen some of this stuff. Again, you might see it once or twice in a career, but whenever I see something, gosh, I started doing this as a resident. I started saving Kodachromes. I had somebody that was sun gazing and had basically a foveal burn or macular hole from that. And my attending gave me that picture. And so since basically for the last 40 years, when I saw something cool, I'd photograph it and I'd save it. And I had a grateful patient who is particularly savvy with digitalizing stuff. He agreed to digitalize hundreds of all these Kodachromes. So that's why I'm able to post all these really cool pictures. I've worked with some very, very talented photographers. We have great photographers at Metro. And my first job out of fellowship was at the University of Arkansas Jones Eye Institute. We had top-notch photographer there. And again, Arkansas, you're out in the middle of nowhere. Look at a map sometimes. It's the only game in the whole state. So you'll see an awful lot of people, again, that don't go to doctors very often. And you're hundreds of miles from the nearest teaching hospital. So we saw lots of very, very unusual stuff there. So some of it goes all the way back to, well, I've been here in Cleveland for about 27 years, but it goes back even further, you know?
Right. We'll definitely put a link down below for all our listeners for our your Instagram channel, which I think is so good. I highly recommend it. I'm a follower. I watch it all the time. Anytime you post something new, I get it.
Thank you, Uday. It's my pleasure. Some of the stuff, I got to say, I mean, I pinch it wherever I can. If I see something cool on my own, I'm going to post it. If I see something cool that's posted on Twitter X, I might post that too, particularly right before the OCAP. There were cool things to kind of help the residents kind of get through the. Again, I tell them, you will see this maybe once in a career, but of course they'll ask you about this stuff and about, you know, oculocutaneous albinism and what the complications are, even though you'll never see this. Right. We actually had a patient that we did cataract surgery on just recently, and I asked her if she had clotting problems or infection problems or respiratory problems. No, she didn't. So I've seen my recent patient with oculocutaneous albinism, but she didn't have anything cool in the eye to share, and she did very well with cataract surgery.
Right. Now, we were talking about corneal ulcers. You were also one of the very first people, maybe 25 years ago, to talk about the cosmetic contact lenses causing corneal. Tell me about that whole story. Tell our audience.
Yeah, I mean, that is another passion of mine, is safety. I've always been very passionate about safety and advocacy for safety for patients. And colored contact lenses kind of came on the scene roughly around the year 2000. And the reason is, up until that time, they were all kind of custom and they were expensive. I mean, we all remember Michael Jackson Thriller video and all that sort of thing. And by the late, say, 1990s, probably 2000, they were basically mass produced. They were cheap. And so we were seeing people all the time that were getting in trouble from buying either cosmetic lenses or what we would now call theatrical or Halloween lenses. These are plain old lenses. People were getting them at costume stores, beauty parlors. They were buying them at corner stores. Now you can buy them off the internet very easily. And I made it a point, particularly after I took care of a 16-year-old with a Pseudomonas corneal ulcer who required hospitalization. I ended up doing a corneal transplant. I mean, my God, what a terrible price to pay at age 16 for a kind of a stupid indiscretion. She and her friends were going out to a prom party. And I don't know this for a fact, but I think they all basically swapped lenses, kind of like you might swap a handbag or eye makeup. I think they all wanted to see what different colors look like. So I think they were all sharing their ocular surface bacteria. Yeah. That was how it started. We were seeing people through the emergency room all the time. Lo and behold, I got the Academy and other groups like Research to Prevent Blindness, Prevent Blindness America. I got local help from the Ohio Ophthalmological. I got help from the Ohio Optometric. And we finally translated this into spreading the word nationally. So I was featured on 2020 on the ABC News Magazine. I was featured in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times. We were trying to get the word out, and basically my senator, now Governor Mike DeWine, but it was Senator Mike DeWine at that time, co-sponsored in the Senate, and Henry Waxman, at that time the congressman from California, co-sponsored in the House. We got a federal law passed that, very simple, all contact lenses are medical devices. Doesn't matter why you're wearing a contact lens. To that point, the law was ambiguous, meaning that to that point you only wore a contact for correction. Now, what if a lens is plano but you're wearing it for fun?
Right.
The makers of a lot of these colored lenses were trying to challenge the FDA by saying, well, we don't have any claims of this is going to improve your vision. It's just for fun. So therefore it's not a medical device. And of course, we pushed back pretty hard, and we had great help from the Academy. And you know what? We got a federal law passed in less than 3 years.
Wow.
So I'm very proud of that. Now, the problem is it's hard to enforce, particularly with the internet. You can buy anything on, you want to, gosh, I mean, you can buy anything on the internet. For all I know, you can probably buy narcotics on the internet if you want to. So you can still buy these crazy decorative theatrical colored lenses, you know, cosmetic lenses on the internet, but that's illegal for the vendor to do that.
Right.
Basically, you have to have a prescription, you have to have teaching, and you have to have follow-up by a certified eye care professional. That's what we wanted to do. Just ensure that it's safely done. If you want to do that, have at it, but just make sure you know the rules of the road and do it safely.
Yeah, I think the general public has no idea. This vital cornea tissue is a half a millimeter thin. It's avascular. It's so delicate. The balance is like, I don't think they get it.
No, they don't get it. And I, quite honestly, for a teenager, imagine a teenager sees these cool colored lenses, and wants them, and maybe doesn't have the means to go and spend, you know, at an eye care professional's office. You might spend $500 for a colored lens that you might wear once in a blue moon. Plus you have your fitting fee, plus you have your exam fee. It's not affordable to a teenager, maybe not even affordable to a college student. And they think, well, what's the risk? What could go wrong? Well, I can tell you, lots can go wrong. You know that. And we've seen it, and we proved it to members of Congress that this should not continue to happen. Unfortunately, it does, because it's a hard law to enforce. But at least technically, we have medical device protection through the Food and Drug Administration, because a lot of this stuff comes from overseas. Mm. And they don't have an FDA quality control in places like India, where some of these lenses are made, or maybe even in China. They're cheaply made. They're made for pennies and even sold for $10 or $20 on the internet, which is very affordable. But some of these lenses, including a study that was done by the FDA, show that a lot of these contraband lenses from overseas that have not passed inspection when they come into ports of entry, a lot of them are contaminated. A lot of them are counterfeit. A lot of them have been rebranded. A lot of them basically have been maybe trial lenses that have been thrown away. They slapped their own label on it. They've broken the sterility, or maybe they never had sterility to begin with. Right. So what I'm saying is there's lots to fear about buying lenses without a prescription.
For sure. Now, have you always been so into advocacy? I saw you also recently, a few years ago, won the American Academy of Ophthalmology Outstanding Advocate Award.
That was really in recognition of a lot of this work that I've done over the years. I work closely with the Washington Office of the American Academy of Ophthalmology. And as I said, they so important in this whole process of not only getting a federal law passed, but also educating the public. So then I teamed up with the San Francisco office. I'm still am a spokesman for the American Academy of Ophthalmology and do lots of stuff through the media to kind of get the word out to the general public, and through basically iSmart. I got to hand it to the Academy. They've had tons of very, very patient focused information on iSmart, which is iSmart.com, which is for patients. I've done a lot of work through the CDC, cdc.com/gov/contact lens. A lot of their work is phenomenal too. There's a whole assortment of patient-focused contact lens material, both at the Academy and at the CDC, and at our partner organizations with the American Optometric Association and American Academy of Optometry.
Wow. So besides this contact lens issue, are there other advocacy kind of interests that you have?
Well, we're just getting ready to publish this, but we're looking at some of the FDA guidelines, which, quite honestly, during the pandemic, I think some of these things kind of fell through the cracks. And we learned it through the advocacy that relates to, I mean, remember about maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, people were using artificial tears, and they were getting resistant strains of Pseudomonas in their eyes. Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember people even dying from it. Imagine dying from an artificial lubricating drop. Why? Again, because a lot of the drops that are made overseas, they are what we call 510 parentheses K parentheses. That's an FDA designation that allows products to be grandfathered in based upon a comparison to something that is, in the words of the FDA, essentially similar or essentially identical, mm-hmm. I guess is the word. And no, if your product in India as an eye drop does not have good quality control, if it's contaminated, likewise with products from medical device products from overseas, if it has not been inspected properly, meaning just they filed the paperwork, but nobody's inspected it. And not only that, no clinical trials.
Wow.
And beyond that, no post-market surveillance. There's no registry for contact lens complications. And trust me, there are 45 million people that wear primarily soft lenses, and a lot of those people get into trouble. I'm not against contacts. I think contacts are great, but some people get into trouble. How many people wear colored lenses? Well, we don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of people who do it illegally. Even with corrective lenses, how many people get in trouble with blinding infection? More than we suspect. And a lot of those people end up worse than 20/60 because of corneal scarring, as you mentioned.
Right. There's a news story today of more than 3 million bottles of eye drops, yes, Article Tears, have been like recalled over it. Like, wow. And these were apparently made in California.
Yeah. And so do they have quality control or QA problems there? Maybe they do. I saw the headline too. I haven't read the article yet. I'll have to go back and see if the FDA has any verbiage on their website, or sometimes the Federal Trade Commission has stuff. I mean, over-the-counter products are regulated by the FDA, but they're also the sales are regulated by the Federal Trade Commission. So it's kind of a weird thing for contact lenses or medical devices. But in this case, you have an over-the-counter lubricating eye drop that's over-the-counter, but it still has the potential to do harm. And so again, some of it may have to do with this so-called 510K, what they call substantial equivalence, which may be problematic because it shows maybe some of these products are not passing inspection. And again, during COVID, man, oh man, lots of stuff. The people that are protecting us, maybe the overwhelmed. And again, in this climate with the new administration, we have kind of an anti-government, I think it's fair to say, intervention or purview. And I'm all for things that, again, relate to safety. And so when we have less inspection, to me, that says potential, not always, but the potential for safety problems. Sure. So I think it's very real.
Yeah, I guess there's a delicate balance, right? I mean,
there is a balance, and it's this was shocking, like you showed, because these are made in California. They are probably what we call generic knockoffs that are sold under a store brand.
Exactly. Exactly what it was. Exactly.
Just like contact lens solution, which is not the same as a teardrop, but contact lens solutions are often sold as a store brand. What that represents is a mishmash. It could be almost anything, both made domestically or even internationally, that the company bought a large odd lot of, in this case, lubricating drops, or in the case of contact lens solution, contact lens disinfecting solution, or rewetting drops. All I'm saying is you don't really know generically what's in that. Where did it come from? Because it's sold under kind of a generic label, a store brand. And most of the time, American store brand, probably fine. Again, when it comes from overseas, when patients ask me, are these drops okay? I said, let me see the bottle. If it's an American brand, I'd say they probably are fine. You know, so it surprises me to see this. As you said, I was shocked. I saw that today. Yeah, blew me away. That's American. I have to go back and do my homework this weekend.
Well, that's my state, California. We're a little bit crazy out here, so you never really know. Now, what advice do you have for a young ophthalmologist? Because a lot of young ophthalmologists, you know, love cataract coach stuff. If they want to get involved in advocacy, what's kind of the first couple of steps? What do you do?
First of all, as a resident, I never ever once thought about advocacy. I was too busy trying to get my numbers in, get my numbers documented, make the attendings happy, pass the OCAP. Right. Past my boards for real. I never once thought about advocacy, but now the American Academy of Ophthalmology has a program, and it's coming up just actually in a couple of weeks. Every year, the Academy has a Washington meeting. It's called the Mid-Year Forum. Okay. Every year, sponsored residents, usually by specialty societies, in the case of contact lenses, my professional organization, the Eye and Contact Lens Association, but you could be sponsored by the Cornea Society. You could be sponsored by the Retina Society. You could be sponsored by your state society, your state ophthalmological society. So again, get interested in advocacy by finding a problem that needs a solution, or basically posing a question, taking it to the society, presenting it to the society. Get sponsored as a so-called advocacy ambassador. The advocacy ambassadors are all residents. They our sponsor to the Mid-Year Forum every year. It's a very exciting thing. You'll learn all the behind-the-scenes policy stuff that most of a large membership does not know what goes on behind the scenes. The Academy Mid-Year Forum will tell you just how hard many people are working, not only in Washington, but in San Francisco, to fight policy battles. And it goes way beyond turf battles.
What do you think are the big battles that we have here? You were saying turf battles, obviously patient safety is one, maybe reimbursement's another. What are the big battles?
Well, I mean, turf battles right now are ongoing, I believe, in 6 or 7 states in the United States. It might even be in California. I don't know. We have a turf battle going on here in Ohio. I don't want to fight turf battles. I'm glad there are people that do this, because I believe strongly that there obviously, in my opinion, there's a huge difference between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist. They just don't have the same training. And I think it's quality. And I think it has a lot to do with hands-on. Again, the kind of stuff that you and I do, we know what the residents can do. Policymakers may not know what the difference is between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist. Don't get me wrong. I'm very respectful for what our optometric colleagues can do, but they're not trained in surgery. And in my opinion, I don't think this is something you can learn in a 2-hour Saturday course, you know?
Right. No, I know that's for sure. What about other battles? Let's say, like, I guess the reimbursement one. We've already seen big headlines this year, right? We're like 11% cut and $463 cataracts.
Yeah, it's depressing. I mean, I don't mind saying, again, see my gray hair, but when I was a resident, and you recall this too, this is in the days of manual extracaps. So you couldn't do 15 or 20 of these or 30 of them in a day, as you can phacos. You might do 4 or 5 in a day, but the reimbursement for Medicare for a cataract was probably close to $2,000. And now it's less than $600, right?
Oh, it's $463.
Wow.
And no, and that's more importantly, you know, it was $2,000, but in $1990.
Yes.
Yes. Not in 2026 dollars.
No. I mean, all it does is keep getting slashed. And again, I don't know what the answer is there, except that the Academy is an effective policy organization. The biggest problem is people like me. I don't know, but you're younger than I am, but I'm telling you that it's the baby boom generation. There's too many of us and not enough of you guys and younger trying to support us.
Right. I mean, here, just and everything else, though, so much more expensive. We're getting our rooms are so cut. Your office overhead, your expenses are so high. I put gas in my car today for 20 gallons.
In California?
20 gallons was $130.
Whoa.
Gallons.
So that's six something a gallon. Is that right?
Six and a half. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just crazy. It's six, basically $6.50, $6.50 a gallon, plus or minus.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a new world.
People will find, and young ophthalmologists will find, it's a whole new world. And likewise, even with my gray hair, I missed the golden days of medicine. I missed the golden days of ophthalmology. That was really and truly the 1970s. And as I said, I finished my residency in 1989. And I've been in practice since 1991, at which time managed care was already firmly entrenched. Yeah. So we were working for less already in the 90s. So 70s and 80s, yeah, pretty good. I didn't know those dollars. And you're right, compared to millennium dollars, I mean, I don't know how you guys do it in a private office, because you can't meet, it's very hard to meet your overhead.
No, it's for sure. And then even now the young generation, because tuition has increased dramatically much faster than inflation. Like med school tuition, I know, believe me, I'm paying for it for kids. You're looking at $80,000 at a minimum for private medical school education per year, tuition alone, let alone living expenses. A lot of your residents now are graduating med school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt.
That's exactly right. I mean, for instance, here in Cleveland, Case Western Reserve has an excellent medical school. It's in the top 10 in the United States. It's a private medical school. It's a private college. And if you go to, again, private medical school, by the time you finish your residency and another 2-year fellowship in retina, I know these guys are in debt. Before they ever get a real job, they're in debt probably about $300,000+.
Right. Well, you know, there's interesting news also recently where there may be antitrust issues with the residency match.
Right. I don't know much about that.
Yeah, when you look at the residency match, I mean, you are locked into a job where you can't negotiate anything. This is all they're going to offer you. And if you do the math on it, right, Medicare's paying for the residency spots. The university or the program is collecting a multiple of what they're paying you. And they're keeping the majority of the payment they're getting to teach you, paying a very small amount. And then if you even look, you could look how good your senior residents right now. It's so amazing. But the PA in the hospital or the nurse practitioner is making way more than they are. Or you're doing a case with the CRNA, you're doing the anesthesia. The CRNA gets a multiple of the senior resident's salary.
Right. Well, I mean, we know this is the reality, is that we have to have physician extenders, whether you're in private or even in a place like a public hospital like Metro. We have PAs and we have techs and we have excellent support. We don't have enough of it, but mm-hmm. I will tell you that without that and without our excellent residents, we couldn't make a go of it because, again, we have a lot of bad debt. And I tell people I see everybody, and I don't see a huge number of uninsured. I see a huge number of underinsured patients.
Yeah. Well, you actually, in L.A., we saw a huge number of uninsured completely. I mean, we spoke Spanish, but 85% of the patients in our county hospital. And so it was just a huge population of patients who just had zero care. But no, I get what you're saying. But I mean, I think one of the issues that we need to resolve, and I'm kind of all for this antitrust thing against the match program, because you're taking advantage of the senior resident for the value that senior residents bring in.
Who's, no question about it.
Who's 30 years old, PGY4, has done umpteen years already of schooling, and you're paying him or her like peanuts. It's nonsense.
I agree with you. You know, you touched on this, I believe, with Mary Q on one of your previous podcasts, sure. And I couldn't agree more. You want the best people, and you're right. A senior resident, I could not do what I do without the help of Quality Institute senior residents. They are enormously helpful. You know?
Yeah, and they're so good. It's like
they are good.
Absolutely. So good. Like sometimes you forget when you're a senior resident. Oh my gosh, your knowledge of ophthalmology is spectacular. Like if you ask me about A pattern or B pattern now, I'm gonna look like a real dummy. But you ask a senior resident, and they got it out. They got it down. No problem.
No, I mean, once again, they have an enormous fund of knowledge. Their breadth of knowledge is impressive. Right. I mean, again, I'm the second to the last grandfathered certification, and you know what? I'm glad of that because I got to tell you, I mean, I don't think I could pass the OCAP, particularly in stuff like neuro and peds. I see adults. And I don't know if I could pass those sections. Those are tough.
Well, you know, the ABO has changed, at least for me. My experience was I took it, obviously, when I finished residency in 2000. So I took the ABO exam maybe 2001. I certified in 2011, where I had to go to a testing center. And it was an actual test. I actually studied for it. And then I recertified in 2021, my second recert. It was just the online questions, the quarterly questions, which I literally did all of them in a couple hours. And so it was like, it was a very, and I think they have pass rates of beyond my guess. Don't make a guess, don't hold me to it. I think it's like 99% or more pass rate. So it's kind of more of a formality than an actual test anymore. So,
right.
But you're right. If I took the original ABO exam that I took when I finished residency, I'd be, oh boy, I'd have to study a lot.
Exactly.
It's challenging. And the crazy part is residency is still 4 years, and yet they learned all the stuff we learned. Plus all the new stuff they figured out in the last 30 years. When I was a resident, there was no OCT machine. You didn't have to read it. There was no anti-VEGF medication. As you said, you didn't even have Phaco.
No.
So it's amazing.
You know, again, to a message to all of the resident docs. First of all, thank you for all that you do for me and for my colleagues. Second of all, to anybody that's a resident fellow or a young practitioner, my goodness, again, lots of resources, but we expect the world of you. We just do. And it is, it's an ever-changing world. But you know what? I still love what I do. I still love going to work every day. And according to Medscape, ophthalmology is still way down on the list of burnout. Right. And I still enjoy practicing And it's there are some days that are harder than others, but man, oh man, am I glad I'm not an ER doc or an internist or a pediatrician. I mean, the burnout is very high in those primary care fields.
Right. I think, for sure, ophthalmology always ranks very high in that. And I am thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist. How did I get so lucky? I'm just thankful. So it's truly a wonderful field. If you were going to give your best kind of pros advice, because we're coming on that time, it's April. You've got a class of senior residents, five of them graduating at the end of June. What's your kind of parting advice? Because you obviously have taught them a lot during the program, but kind of more like words of wisdom, not necessarily surgical pearls. What advice do you have as they embark on their fellowship and then career?
First of all, probably better than half, maybe 2/3 to 3/4 of our residents do a fellowship. So they're going to invest at least a year, maybe 2 years. And because Cole Eye Institute is well known in retina, a lot of them self-select. They choose Cole as a resident because they want to do retina, even as a medical student.
Wow.
So what I would say is, if you're interested in retina, that's great. If you're interested in the front of the eye, I encourage them. I say, invest an extra year and do cornea or do glaucoma. And the reason is that you'll likely become even a better surgeon, and you'll likely become a very busy cataract surgeon very quickly. I think it's worth the extra year, but that's just me. We have some people that do comprehensive coming out of residency, and they're well-prepared. As I said, the numbers in Shirley Wu's paper on the influence of the wet lab show it. And what I would tell, parting words of wisdom, I would kind of say to them, don't worry, it's all going to work out. Secondly, mm-hmm. trust your judgment. You know way more than you give yourself credit for. And a lot of them worry needlessly. Oh, I don't want to be wrong. Well, you know what? You're right about 90+% of the time when you and I are talking,
Yeah. Try. That's some great advice, because I had that issue when I was first starting up. I thought, I don't know enough. Maybe I'm wrong. A little too much self-doubt.
Well, I think that it's natural. I mean, in those days, the whole concept of imposter syndrome, that's a new concept. And I'll be the first to admit, I think I had imposter syndrome for years, even as an attending. And why not? Because in old school, nobody answered your questions. All they did was ask another question. So you had Socratic questioning, the questions with no answers, Socratic questioning up the wazoo. And then you had people, basically interrogating you in front of others and sometimes shaming you in front of others. And, I'm not surprised that a whole bunch of people may still feel, if you're of the mindset that you're kind of conscientious and you internalize this stuff, I could see why people maybe develop imposter syndrome. Plus, as the more you know about something, the more you think you don't know about it, but you really do.
Right. Exactly. When you get that, you and I, like tens of thousands of cases later, you're just like, I know some, but I don't know enough. Whereas if you asked me after case number 300, I thought I was a genius.
Well, yeah. And I just posted that curve. It's on the internet, but I think I posted this on LinkedIn. But it shows basically it's a modified Dunning-Kruger curve, yeah. Learning curve. It's the learning curve. And it's tailored for cataract surgery, and you have the valley of doom, when you start doubting yourself, and then it comes back up again when you hit, what is it, 500 cases,
right,
or 1,000 cases. And so we give them a great start here. Our residents, I'm proud to say, they graduate in the 95th percentile nationwide of class one surgeries. And wow. So I tell them, don't doubt yourself. You know what to do. And I let them do it. And they, as I said, they have way more poise and they have way more knowledge about stuff than I did at that time. I assure you. And that's what I would tell any resident. You know what to do. Trust your judgment.
You're right. I agree with you. And have faith, because some of these young people are going to do my FACO and yours one day.
Exactly. And you know what? They're ready. They're ready. I'm with them every step of the way. And as I said, they're impressive. I'm very, very fortunate to work with some very talented and very dedicated people, and they should have no doubt about their future, whatever it may be, front or back of the eye.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I understand. After this last hour of talking, I totally get why you won all those half dozen teaching awards. You're amazing. The residents are very fortunate to have someone like you. I hope you realize you changed their lives and their careers like forever. The next 40 years of their practice are heavily influenced by like your teachings.
Well, I'm glad to do it. Like I say, it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. And I tell people, again, it's experiential learning. I can show you how to read a bike, but you have to get on the bike and you'll fall off the bike too. And that's okay. It really is. We should de-stigmatize any of this stuff. Right. It's just a matter of fact. And as well as I do from working at LA County, a lot of these people have tremendous cellulopathy. We don't know until we get there.
Right. Yeah. Lots of surprises. No, that's for sure. Well, Tim, I want to thank you again for spending the last hour chatting with us. Learned a lot. I'm definitely putting your Instagram link down below. If you're an ophthalmologist, you owe it to yourself to see these posts. You're going to learn a lot. I love them.
So, yes, please go to Instagram, Tim Steineman. You will see some really ugly eyes, and you might see some very cute dogs. We have three dogs in our household, two golden retrievers and a chihuahua. So you may see some cute dogs, but mostly ugly eyes that are bizarre diagnoses.
it's helpful though, because then that sticks in your head, and then because we're all visual learners, like you said, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I'm going to see something like, I know this. I've seen this before. I know what this is.
Yeah, so, exactly.
I think it's great. Again, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, you definitely find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. Remember to also check out our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com, where they have retina videos and, of course, the retina podcast too. So until next time, I'll catch you later.